to this special WERU presentation from the 2018 Camden Conference. I'm Jim Campbell. The theme of the 31st Annual Camden Conference, held in February of 2018 in Camden, Maine, was New World Disorder and America's Future. Our presentation from the conference on today's program is by keynote speaker Stephen M. Walt. Dr. Walt is the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University, the author of numerous books on foreign affairs, and an editorial board member on a number of journals focused on foreign policy. His presentation at the Camden Conference was entitled, "The Best of Times or Worst of Times?" Here is Stephen Walt.
Thank you very much. It is a pleasure to be here tonight. I want to thank the program committee and the rest of the organizers for inviting me. I want to thank Gordon for the kind introduction, the plug for Stanford. Thank all of you for coming or for watching it from afar. We're fortunate, I think, to have a terrific program of speakers this year, and I'm going to do my best to start things off on a high note. Because it is Friday evening, because we have been well fed, some may have been well lubricated, I will also try to provide enough intellectual espresso to keep you awake. So my title is The Best of Times or the Worst of Times. Now, of course, this echoes Charles Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities, which is set in the time of the French Revolution. The current world scene isn't quite as turbulent as the years following that great upheaval, but there's still a widespread sense that the world order we have known for decades is crumbling before our eyes. I want to consider if that view is warranted and suggest what might explain it. I'm going to argue the United States is, in fact, responsible for a lot of what has gone wrong in recent years, not all of it, but a lot, and that those failures helped bring Donald Trump to the presidency. I'm then going to consider what Trump has done to fix it and explain why he's, in fact, making a bad situation worse. And I'll conclude with a few ideas about how we might do things a little differently. But let me start by considering if the present upheaval is really as bad as everyone says. Some of you probably saw the long interview between Bill Gates and my Harvard colleague Steven Pinker in the New York Times a few weeks ago, where both men argued that human beings are in fact far better off today than they used to be, and that all the doom and gloom we normally hear is really quite misleading. And to be fair, there's a lot to be said for that perspective. Compared to life in the Middle Ages, for example, our condition today looks pretty darn good. To be specific, the number of armed conflicts, wars, and annual battle deaths declined sharply from 1990 to about 2010, and are ticking up slightly since then, but still much lower than during the Cold War, and certainly much lower than earlier eras. The number of mass killings has also declined, despite obvious tragedies such as the Rwandan genocide. According to the United Nations Human Development Index, over the past 30 years, every region of the world has shown an increase in key indicators of human welfare. The death toll from major famines has plummeted. The number of people suffering from starvation or malnourishment has declined sharply. So has infant mortality and gender inequality. Technology and medicine continue to make remarkable strides. Over the past three decades, more than 1 billion people worldwide have been lifted out of extreme poverty. And until recently, the absolute number of democracies and the number of people living in a democracy was also rising. So those who argue we are in fact living in the best of times do have a case. But of course, some of their claims are somewhat sensitive to when you start counting. For example, the idea that violence is declining looks very convincing if you start in 1941, because, of course, World War II was a high point, and we haven't had a great power conflict like that, fortunately, since. Second, it's not clear how much credit you would give the United States for some of those trends. For example, the decline in extreme poverty worldwide is heavily driven by the fact that there's been rapid economic growth in China and now India, and that's mostly their doing, not ours. And then lastly, and this is the sobering part, even if those long-term trends are largely positive, we could have done even better. The world might be better off than it used to be, but a lot worse than it could have been. And that's, again, the bad news. The world we live in today is a lot worse than the world we expected to be living in when the Cold War ended. You all remember what we thought back then. We had won the Cold War. We had supposedly reached the end of history. Public intellectuals like Frank Fukuyama and Thomas Friedman were telling us that the American model of market-based liberal democracy was really the only one that would work in a globalized era. This was the famous unipolar moment. The world was converging towards us. The wind was at our back. Our only problems were a few pesky dictators like Gaddafi or Milosevic or Saddam Hussein who hadn't gotten the memo. Back in 1993, we were on good terms with all the major powers, including Russia and China. Democracy was spreading worldwide, including Latin America, the former Soviet Empire. Iraq had been disarmed. UN inspectors were carting away its WMD equipment. Iran had exactly zero nuclear centrifuges operating, and the 1994 agreed framework appeared to cap North Korea's nuclear program as well. Globalization was spreading rapidly under American auspices with the formation of the World Trade Organization, the opening up of financial markets around the world. NATO was expanding, and so was the EU, culminating in the creation of the euro. Finally, the Oslo Accords created genuine hopes we would finally reach an elusive peace in the Middle East. Now, given all that, it's not surprising that lots and lots of smart people believed we were entering a new era of peace and prosperity, all under the benevolent leadership of the mighty United States. Now consider the world we're in today. China's power has grown steadily. It is now openly seen as a major long-term rival or peer competitor. Russia has seized Crimea, interfered in several other states, and our relationship with Moscow is now worse than at any time since the Cold War. Not surprisingly, Moscow and Beijing are cooperating in various ways to try and keep the United States in check. Democracy is in retreat worldwide. According to Freedom House, quote, "Democracy faced its most serious crisis in decades in 2017 as its basic tenets came under attack around the world. 71 countries suffered net declines in political rights and civil liberties. Only 35 registered gains. This marked the 12th consecutive year of decline in global freedom." Even more remarkably, last year, the Economist Intelligence Unit's annual Democracy Index downgraded the United States from a full to a flawed democracy. Since 93, North Korea, India, and Pakistan have all tested nuclear weapons. Iran went from zero centrifuges 25 years ago to 19,000 in 2015 before signing the nuclear deal. And it is now essentially a latent nuclear power with the ability to get a nuclear bomb if it ever wants one. Repeated attempts to broker an Israeli-Palestinian peace were humiliating failures. The number of Israeli settlers has tripled since 1993, and the two-state solution sought by three U.S. presidents is farther away than ever. We were attacked at home on September 11th, and we responded by invading Afghanistan, then Iraq, and launching a global war on terror. None of those projects turned out well, and the United States is still fighting in more than half a dozen countries with no end in sight. Meanwhile, the rest of the Middle East is in flames, and American interference helped create failed states in Libya and Yemen and Syria as well. The 2008 financial crisis began here in the United States, puncturing the myth that Wall Street and the US Treasury were better at running a modern economy than anyone else. And one further consequence of that was the euro crisis, which has seriously damaged the European Union as well. So back in 2016, when a man named Donald Trump said American foreign policy is, quote, a complete and total disaster, and when he accused the foreign policy establishment of being out of touch and unaccountable, a lot of people around the country nodded their heads in agreement. So what had gone wrong here? Well, American foreign policy isn't responsible for all of those unfortunate trends, but we had a big hand in a lot of them. In particular, I would argue those setbacks are the result of the broad strategy we have followed ever since the end of the Cold War, a strategy one might call liberal hegemony. The strategy is liberal, not in the sense of being left-wing, but because it seeks to use American power to defend and spread the traditional liberal principles of individual freedom, rule of law, democratic governance, market-based economics. The strategy is one of hegemony because it sees the United States as the indispensable power that is uniquely qualified to bring those political principles to other countries and to bring other states into a web of alliances and institutions designed and led by the United States. But notice, it's a highly revisionist grand strategy. Instead of defending our own territory, upholding the balance of power in key strategic regions, liberal hegemony seeks to spread democracy and markets around the world, peacefully if possible, but if necessary, by force. It further assumes the United States has the right, the responsibility, and the wisdom to manage local politics almost anywhere. Now, since the end of the Cold War, that basic approach has commanded a consensus in both political parties, inside the Defense Department, inside the State Department, and inside the intelligence services. And of course, in most of the think tanks and foreign policy organizations in Washington. Why? In part because the people in all of those institutions share these basic ideals, but also, of course, because this very ambitious strategy enhances their power and status and gives them plenty to do. Unfortunately, the strategy is fundamentally flawed. For starters, it expanded the number of places that the United States was committed to defend, but it didn't increase the resources available to defend it. Because, of course, some of the places we were now promising to protect were weak and vulnerable, and wealthy American allies continued to free ride. In fact, by 2016, the end of the Obama administration, the United States was formally committed to defending more states than at any time in its entire history. Second, spreading liberal values, while good as an ideal, inevitably threatened non-democratic regimes. They naturally began to look for ways to thwart us. Expanding NATO into Eastern Europe poisoned our relationship with Russia. Toppling Saddam and then Gaddafi gave North Korea and Iran even more reason to seek weapons of mass destruction. Third, this strategy assumes we know how to create a democracy in the wake of regime change. But the past 25 years has proven that we don't, and we don't seem to be getting any better with practice. Instead, regime change leads to failed states or costly military occupations or both, triggering local resistance and sometimes inspiring terrorism. Fourth, opening and expanding global markets did produce genuine benefits for us and for others, but Wall Street did better than Main Street did. Inequality rose dramatically, and the global financial system, as we learned in 2008, became more delicate. Fifth, our dominant position led the United States to downgrade diplomacy in favor of economic sanctions or the direct use of force. We forgot that reaching agreements that will actually last requires some degree of give and take, because our opponents have interests too. By the way, on those rare occasions where we didn't act that way, as in, I believe, the nuclear talks with Iran, we actually made progress and we actually got results. Last but not least, liberal hegemony created a world order that was excessively dependent on Washington doing the right thing in lots of different places, including lots of places we didn't understand very well. We thought being the indispensable power all over the world would guarantee stability. The opposite proved to be the case. In retrospect, building an order that would have been less dependent on constant American management might have been a better bet. And by 2016, those accumulated failures helped open the door for Trump. So what did he promise to do? Well, you know all this. He said America First would be the guiding principle of his foreign policy. He said NAFTA, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and other multilateral deals were all very bad trade deals. He said NATO was obsolete, and they had to start paying us to defend them. He was deeply critical of the European Union, praised the Brexit vote in England, embraced right-wing nationalists like Marine Le Pen in France. He promised repeatedly the United States would get out of the nation-building business. He said rivalry with Russia and China was not inevitable, and Vladimir Putin, of course, was one of the only foreign leaders he never criticized. He called the nuclear deal with Iran the worst deal ever and showed no interest in promoting democracy or advancing human rights, just not something he ever talked very much about at all. When you think about it, his approach in the campaign was as clear a repudiation of liberal hegemony as you could have asked for, which is why, of course, the entire foreign policy establishment, including dozens of experienced Republican officials, openly opposed Trump and called him, quote, utterly unfit for the office. Those were Republicans, not Democrats. So what did he do once elected? Well, to be fair, he began with some unusual steps. He appointed a controversial general, Michael Flynn, as national security advisor, along with some other rather inexperienced oddballs like, say, Sebastian Gorka. He left the director of national intelligence and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff off the NSC Principles Committee, something his predecessors had not done, and put political strategist Steve Bannon on the Principles Committee. He put Rex Tillerson at the State Department, despite Tillerson's lack of diplomatic experience. He declined to fill dozens of positions, saying in one interview, they're unnecessary, and saying in another interview, I'm the only one that matters. On his third day in office, he abandoned the Trans-Pacific Partnership and a few weeks later left the Paris Climate Change Accord. He continued to tweet out provocative statements and didn't hesitate to contradict U.S. officials or pick fights with a variety of foreign leaders, including the heads of a number of close American allies. And I think it's safe to say that throughout, his entire style has been radically different than all past presidents. But look what happens over time. Over time, it becomes clear that U.S. strategy has not really changed. Within 7 months, the radicals in his administration are all gone and replaced by mainstream figures. The American commitment to NATO has now been reaffirmed repeatedly under President Trump. Our commitment to the same set of Middle Eastern allies is, if anything, deeper. There has been lots of bluster and saber-rattling towards North Korea, but like his predecessors, he seems to be being reluctantly dragged back towards some kind of diplomacy. Trump has proposed an increase in defense spending, but that is hardly new in Washington. All recent presidents have been committed to preserving American military primacy and have been extremely deferential to military advice. And of course, although Trump has done more damage to the State Department than his predecessors, he is hardly the first to give the State Department short shrift. So far, he hasn't torn up NAFTA or the Iran Treaty. And for that matter, his hostility towards Iran is hardly out of line with the Washington consensus. So there's nothing new there either. I would even argue that Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital is not a radical departure either. It's a difference, but it's not a radical shift. Critics say it hurts the peace process, to which I would respond, what peace process? The two-state solution is on life support, if not completely flatlined. And it is not exactly headline news in 2018 to learn that the United States is firmly in Israel's corner and is not going to use its influence to produce a lasting settlement. All Trump did was remove the last pretense that the United States is even-handed. Finally, he has paid less rhetorical attention to democracy promotion, nation building, and human rights, but the differences here are not as profound as you might think. Just like President Obama, he bowed to military pressure and agreed to increase U.S. troop levels in Afghanistan. And no matter how often he has denied it, we are still doing nation building there, still doing nation building on his watch. Second, both he and Secretary of State Tillerson view human rights primarily as a cudgel with which to browbeat our enemies, such as Iran, while giving our allies mostly a free pass. Now, admitting this openly isn't all that clever. But this is, in fact, what past American presidents have done, too, including Clinton, Bush, and Obama. They criticized our adversaries for human rights violations, and they tended to look the other way when our friends did the same thing. The bottom line here is that Trump's foreign policy isn't the radical departure he promised when he ran for office. The blob has reined him in, and many key elements of liberal hegemony remain firmly intact. This is bad news in two senses. We still have a failed grand strategy, but it is now being implemented by the least competent president in modern memory, a man whose White House was described by a senior Republican politician as a snake pit, and whose turnover rate among senior staff is the highest in history. The good news is that he has a ways to go before he will have done anything quite as dumb as invading Iraq. But there's no question, he's diminished America's stature in the world, and especially the sense that the United States has sound judgment and competent leadership. And here's what I mean by that. Near the end of Obama's second term, a Pew survey of 37 countries found that on average, roughly 64% of the respondents said they had confidence in US leadership. After less than 6 months under President Trump, the percentage with confidence had fallen to 22%. When asked who was more likely to do the right thing in world affairs, Xi Jinping, Vladimir Putin, or Donald Trump, in that same survey, President Trump came in third. That, in a nutshell, is why I consider this the worst of times. So let me close by briefly sketching what we might do instead. We could start by abandoning our habitual paranoia and recognize that the United States is, in fact, still the luckiest and most secure great power in history. We have a large population and a sophisticated entrepreneurial economy. We have extremely capable military forces. We are separated from the other major power centers in the world by these two enormous oceans, and those oceans still matter for our security. We also, by the way, have thousands of nuclear weapons of our own, making a direct existential attack on American soil even less likely. Given that enormous good fortune, the overarching goal of our foreign policy should be to make sure that no other major power is in a comparable position, by which I mean dominates its region the same way we dominate the Western Hemisphere. Such a state would have an economy as big as ours, the ability to project power around the world the way we do now, including, if it wished, into the Western Hemisphere. Well, the good news is that there is no potential hegemon like that in Europe today. Russia and Germany have declining populations. There's no one else that could conceivably try and dominate Europe. The United States should therefore remove its military forces and gradually turn European security back over to the Europeans, not by next week, but gradually. It's worth noting Europe has more than 500 million people, a combined economy of 17 trillion. Russia, which everyone regards as the great threat to Europe, has 140 million people, a GDP of less than 2 trillion. NATO's European members spend four times more on defense every year than Russia does. They don't spend it very well, but the idea that Europe lacks the wherewithal to defend itself against potential external threats is a myth. So it's not clear why the United States needs to do very much to defend them. And to be fair, here Trump's instincts were, I think, correct. The bad news is that China is a potential hegemon in Asia. Ideally, the United States would let local powers contain it, manage it, keep it preoccupied, but they may not be able to do that without a fair bit of US help. Here, the United States probably has to take a lead in coordinating a balancing coalition, and that will be an extremely complicated diplomatic, economic, and to some degree military effort. Again, that's why the TPP decision was such a blunder, and it's why gutting the State Department is so foolish, because this is a task that requires subtle and sophisticated diplomacy, which we will soon be incapable of doing. As for the Middle East, our main interest there is the preservation of a regional balance of power to ensure that no single power is able to dominate the area. Well, the Middle East is more divided today than it has ever been. Nobody's going to be able to dominate or control it. We shouldn't try to do that ourselves. We should not try to take sides in the struggle between Sunnis and Shia, between Saudi Arabia and Iran. In fact, to take that one step further, the United States should stop having special relationships with countries in the Middle East and have normal relationships with them instead. None of our current allies deserve unconditional American support, not Egypt, not Israel, not Jordan, not Saudi Arabia, not Turkey. The United States should support these countries when our interests are aligned. We should distance ourselves when they don't align. And we should strive for a businesslike working relationship with Iran, because that will increase our leverage with everyone else, facilitate cooperation when our interests do overlap, and reduce Iran's incentive to pursue weapons of mass destruction or move closer to some of our other adversaries. Two more points. We would also do well, I think, to de-emphasize the role of military power in our foreign policy and put greater priority on peace. And I say that with some misgivings, but I'll explain what I mean. You hardly ever hear US politicians use the word peace anymore, or hear them say that peace is in America's national interest. Why? Because they don't want to appear soft or fuzzy-minded. But peace, of course, should be our goal in almost all, not all, but almost all circumstances. Remember, the United States is in great shape. We're already sitting on top of the world with little to gain from conflict abroad. Peace is good for the American economy. A more peaceful world is one where we don't need a lot of intrusive government surveillance or other threats to civil liberties. Peacetime tends to elevate people who are skilled at promoting human welfare. Warfare tends to elevate those who are good at using violence, who stand to gain from the hatred of others, the very people who naturally become warlords, terrorists, or dictators. And finally, peace is morally preferable. War creates an enormous amount of human suffering. Alleviating it when we can is intrinsically desirable. Let me be very clear here. I am a realist, and I am not naive about the nasty nature of international politics. But in my view, from a hard-headed, selfish, unsentimental, realist perspective, peace is in America's interest, and our leaders should not hesitate to say so. And in that spirit, let me just add that I think a military parade in Washington is about the dumbest idea you can think of. One last point. Instead of ignoring democracy and human rights, we should promote them. We should promote them actively, and we should promote them, most importantly, by setting a good example. Spreading democracy via regime change does not work. Creating a society others would want to emulate would be good for us here at home and good for others too. And needless to say, there are no shortage of problems that need urgent attention back home. The tragic irony in all of this is that the American people would almost certainly support a more realistic foreign policy. Getting out of the nation-building business, reducing our military footprint in Europe and the Middle East, seeking a realistic, hard-headed rapprochement with Iran and Russia, focusing more attention on our partners in Asia would all make sense and would free up additional resources that could be used to improve the lives of Americans here at home. I believe if Donald Trump had implemented that approach in a systematic and disciplined way, his foreign policy would have, in fact, bolstered his support with his base and also won over some new fans. But I think it's clear after a year that President Trump does not have the temperament to pursue this sensible course. He's more inclined to pick fights to no good purpose, encourage instability in places we would prefer were tranquil, and act so erratically that even our friends have lost confidence in our steadiness. None of this is in America's interest or likely to produce a more orderly or tranquil world. So when I contemplate the next 3 years, I am reminded of something Chancellor Otto von Bismarck of Germany supposedly said, that there appears to be a special providence that looks after drunkards, fools, and the United States of America. More than ever before, I hope Bismarck was right. Thank you very much.
We've just heard a presentation by Professor Stephen Walt made at the 2018 Camden Conference here on WERU-FM at 89.9 in Blue Hill, 99.9 in Bangor, and on the web at weru.org. Dr. Walt's talk was entitled The Best of Times or Worst of Times. Following his presentation, there was a question and answer session moderated by former senior White House official for national security, Gordon Adams. Here are excerpts from that Q&A session.
Thank you, Steve. That was quite a tour of the horizon, and now I guess I should say let the games begin. So let me try to backtrack a little bit, Steve, and get you to talk a little bit more about where we stand today. It does seem to me that Donald Trump touched something. And I think you made reference to that in what you had to say. He has touched something. People have heard something that he said, and it had something to do with nation building and not doing it. It had something to do with overcommitment and not doing it. It had something to do with taking care of America first. All those seem to resonate. There's a package in there that says he might have been onto something. First question, was he onto something? And second, if you're right about the way he is actually executing, nonetheless, does that something that he's onto and his character so worry people in other countries in the world that he's actually accelerating the reaction to American policy and the use of American power today?
There's sort of two parts to that. And first of all, I think it's clear that it resonated with a substantial fraction of the American electorate, including some people who didn't ultimately vote for him. You might remember in the election that Bernie Sanders on foreign policy actually sounded an awful lot like Donald Trump, not on everything. But Bernie Sanders got a lot of support in the Democratic Party. So you had this view that the United States was overcommitted coming from, you know, wherever you think Trump comes from, and coming from Sanders on the left. Well, Trump is hard to label as a sort of true conservative or anything like that. So that view was out there. I think in April 2016, there was a poll done here in the United States, also I think by Pew, something like 57% of the people that were asked, so roughly 50% of the American electorate, said they thought the United States should concentrate on its own problems first and let other countries get along as best they can. 57% agreed with that. I think something like 27% disagreed with that. Now, people who do foreign policy for a living, people who are engaged in it, I think more educated elites, et cetera, have a more involvement, engagement approach. They don't necessarily accept that. But when Trump went out there and said he wasn't going to do those dumb things, a lot of people resonated with them. I would also say one other point there, and that's remember that the previous presidential elections had the same pattern. Bill Clinton, what was his slogan? It's the economy, stupid. And he was running against George Herbert Walker Bush, a great foreign policy president. George W. Bush said he was going to give us a humble foreign policy and criticized Clinton for too much nation building. Barack Obama comes in the wake of the Iraq War, says, I'm not going to do dumb things like that. I'm going to rebuild our relationship with the world. So all of these presidents have run promising to have a smarter, more restrained, more sensible foreign policy. And Trump is no different. And interestingly enough, all of those presidents end up doing, in their own particular way, kind of the same thing. Where I think Trump is different, first of all, apart from the sort of erratic nature of the decision making and the hollowing out of a lot of these institutions, like the State Department most notably, is the sheer unpredictability. Right. So even countries that are not hostile to the United States, who want to do business with the United States, who want to know where the United States stands on either an economic set of issues or a set of military, security, diplomatic issues, have no idea at this point, partly because they can't get a straight answer out of Washington because the machinery is not running particularly well, and also because even if they do get an answer from one of the few officials that actually has been appointed and confirmed, it may be undercut next Tuesday by a tweet. And at that point, which is the one that's actually speaking for what American policy might be. So regardless of where you are philosophically on President Trump and what he wants to do with the country and all of that, the fact that other countries have relatively little idea what to expect from the United States is probably not a good thing. Foreign policy is an area where being unpredictable has a real downside. It's not, you know, like being doing real estate deals or running a reality show.
Somebody up on the balcony who's a student who has a question?
You make a point that when Trump tweets, he can sometimes undercut his foreign policy or any policy that he's making. What do you propose might help fix that? Like, do you think we're stuck with social media as part of our political climate now?
Yes. I don't see us unwinding social media. I don't imagine a world where, you know, things like Facebook disappear. You can imagine the nature of the social media environment starting to change, people starting to recognize that this has pernicious consequences. I actually know people who work even in the programming world and in the sort of infrastructure of social media who are now worrying much more about this problem in ways they didn't back when Facebook and Twitter were being created. That's one sort of broader set of problems that will transcend this president and the next president and the president after that. It's just part of the world we're now going to be living in. The other question, what do you do about this particular president who appears to use Twitter in a particularly, I'll just say, undisciplined way? And you have to respect it in one sense. He used this for a long time, and it's one of the reasons he got elected. It was a very effective campaign tool for him. It was a way for him to reach directly out to lots of people in lots of different ways and dominate the news cycle on the cheap. He would tweet something out in the middle of the campaign, and that's all anyone would talk about for the next week. How was Hillary Clinton supposed to lay out what her tax plan was or what her health care plan was or what she was going to do about the situation in Pakistan when everyone was talking about some tweet he'd done about, you know, I don't know, an actress? And that's a particular president's use of this. I don't think that's going to change because this has been part of his modus operandi all along.
We have a question down here. Just tell us your name and where you live.
I'm Charles Graham from Camden. All of your discussion has been about the foreign relations and what the United States should do. But it seems to me that we are now paralyzed by a dysfunctional Congress that seems to be under the rule of their campaign finance, and a population of voters who seem to be dysfunctional as well. Do you see any hope for this foreign policy changes given these two facts?
In the short term, no. And if I'm asked, you know, sort of what worries me the most about the condition of the country these days, I never say some cunning set of foreign adversaries whose clever stratagems will be outwitting us and putting us in peril. It's not that we don't have enemies. It's not that we don't have people out there who would like to harm us. But I don't think any of them are as consequential as the damage we are managing to do to ourselves. Now, having said that, I want to emphasize my training and my principal intellectual activity is in foreign affairs, international politics, things like that. I am not a student of American politics, so I am now beginning to practice political science without a license. Now, I'm moving into areas that are not my domain, but I'll say two things on that. First, there have been other moments in our history where we've been deeply polarized. There have been other moments in our history where economic inequality has been as great as it was as it is today. There have been other moments in our history when those things were true and we were also dealing with a lot of concerns about immigration and things like that. This is where the progressive movement came out of. We've had political movements that emerged out of particular sets of conditions. They start at the grassroots, they find political leaders as well. And in the case of the progressive movement, it had a transformative effect, I think ultimately a positive transformative effect on our politics. And something like that could happen again. But there's no guarantee it will happen. It's just a possibility. Second point I would make is just to steal a point from one of my Harvard colleagues, Daniel Ziblatt, whose book, How Democracies Die, I heartily recommend. And one of the things he points out is that what makes a democracy work isn't just the Constitution, isn't just reliable electoral machines and things like that, counting the votes properly, having good laws and decent lawyers. What makes democracy work is also what he calls the soft guardrails of democracy, the informal norms that we practice that aren't part of the formal rules. They are the informal norms that say when there's a year to go in a president's last year and he nominates someone for the Supreme Court, that person actually gets a vote and probably gets confirmed if they're qualified. That's the way we've always done it in the past. We didn't do it this past time around, and that's a violation of one of those informal norms. It's the idea that you compromise occasionally, that when you're in power, you don't try to ram everything through that you can possibly get. Those are informal norms. There's nothing written in the Constitution that says it has to be that way. And if we don't start rebuilding and restoring some of those, then I think we're going to see the problems we're having today get worse.
We have a question from remote location. Given Russia's success in Crimea and Ukraine, what chance is there that Russia will stay at its present level?
Well, I guess I am of the view that Russia remains a declining power. And for those of you who are racing out to buy the latest Russian iPhone, you know, the latest Russian smartphone, you know, maybe I'm wrong. But this is a country whose population is getting older. Its population is getting smaller. It's heavily dependent upon raw materials exports, oil and gas for income. And the long-term prospects for oil and gas do not look bright. Price is going to go down over time for a whole variety of reasons. So all of this is bad. What Russia managed to do by seizing Crimea and interfering in Ukraine was a geopolitical accomplishment for them, which is basically to halt the eastward expansion of NATO. That's far enough, is basically what they were able to do. And from a Russian point of view, this made perfect sense and is, I think, considered, from their perspective, a real success, a real victory. Right, they finally had stopped us from continuing to move NATO and all these Western institutions eastward. By the way, the fact that they were sensitive about that is no different than the United States being sensitive about people interfering in the Western Hemisphere. Just think of all the times we have wanted to make sure that some government we didn't like didn't gain power in Nicaragua or El Salvador or one of those places. What they were doing is really not that different than what all great powers do, which is to worry a lot about what's happening on their borders. I'm not defending what they did, I'm just explaining it. Nonetheless, so I think they regard that as a success, but everything else Putin has done is just, I think, delaying the inevitable, which is Russia declining as a major power, being primarily a spoiler that can have modest influence in places relatively close to Russia itself, and not turning Russia around in ways that would make it a really formidable power later on in the 21st century.
We have a question up in the balcony.
Hi, my name's Nicole Paris. I'm with University of Maine at Farmington. And my question is, how would you reconcile Trump's America First policy and America's self-identity as a global leader or a global hegemon in regards to isolationist foreign policies?
First of all, the fact that he even used the phrase America First, right, which has a historical resonance. It was the isolationist phrase out of the 1930s of people who did not want the United States to get involved in World War II. And it carries a bunch of other rather noxious baggage with it as well, which is to me is unfortunate to have resurrected something that comes with all of those associations as well. You know, as Bill Clinton once told George Stephanopoulos, right, when George Stephanopoulos was his press secretary, he said to him at one point in an aside, you know, by the way, Americans are basically isolationists. This was Bill Clinton talking about the country. And what he meant by that was that we have a limited appetite for global adventures. And if they get to be really expensive or really costly, we better have a really good reason, like defeating Nazi Germany or containing the Soviet Union. But if you don't have a really big reason like that, and it starts to look expensive, the American people are going to lose interest in this project. And I think, again, that's what Trump has tapped into. It gets back to the very first question you asked me. If the past 25 years of liberal hegemony could just trot up a whole bunch of successes, you know, Iraq's in great shape, Afghanistan's in doing fine, peace in the Middle East, Europe growing and thriving, if this had all worked out beautifully, Gaddafi gone, democracy there, then people would have said, you know, we should continue to be the indispensable power. This really works out well. But in fact, none of these projects worked out particularly well. Many of them failed and made things worse. And oh, by the way, while we've been busy spending trillions of dollars to no good purpose, China has been making money, growing, developing its economy, building the sinews of modern infrastructure, gaining influence, not invading other countries, developing a highly professional diplomatic service, sending students all over the world. And if you wake up in 2060 and you discover that it's largely a Sinocentric world, or in many ways a Sinocentric world, in ways that I don't think are necessarily an existential threat to us, but we might find uncomfortable in a variety of ways, it'll be in part because we took our eye off the ball and squandered a lot of resources on projects that didn't work out particularly well.
Question over here.
Jim Matlack from Rockport. A particular instance of a very naughty problem that Trump and all of us face, North Korea. The reckless language and the kind of loose way in which conversations about bloody nose, I don't believe that's necessarily going to happen, but nor do I trust the kind of deterrent stability of the relationship between two such eccentric leaders. How do we create a policy that avoids some real catastrophe in the North Korean instance?
Well, obviously, we all, I think, worry about that. I guess, and this may be naive of me, but I guess I am more sanguine about this than most people are. And I'm more sanguine about it because it seems to me the circumstances there do not afford any real military options. This is something the Secretary of Defense Mattis has said on a number of occasions. There are just no attractive military options for dealing with North Korea. They weren't particularly attractive even before North Korea had a small nuclear arsenal. They are even less attractive afterwards. And this is why, as I said in my formal remarks, I believe that Trump has been somewhat reluctantly sort of dragged back towards diplomacy. You know, at one point he tweeted that Tillerson was wasting his time trying to get a diplomatic process. That's the kind of confidence your Secretary of State really wants to hear. But in fact, partly because of the initiatives of the South Korean president, President Moon, partly because of what Kim Jong-un has done, the fact that they've seized upon this fortuitous opportunity of the Winter Olympics to start something of a dialogue, and because there isn't an attractive other thing to do, even Donald Trump, despite the tweets, despite the name calling, et cetera, is, I think, going to be back where Barack Obama was, where George W. Bush was, and where Bill Clinton was, trying to talk to these people and figure out if there is some sort of modus vivendi that can be worked out that addresses some of our larger concerns and addresses some of their concerns. And that gets back to this other point I tried to make, is there's not going to be a deal with North Korea in which they give us absolutely everything we want in exchange for nothing in return. It's just not going to happen that way. It's not the way diplomacy works, even with a country that's substantially weaker than we are. So I think that's where we're going to end up, but it's going to be a bumpier ride, it seems to me, than it needs to be. Just one final little footnote in there. There is this proposal you occasionally hear about, the sort of bloody nose idea, that, well, we have to go show them we're willing to use force by blowing something up. And I could think of different things you might do and ways you might try to orchestrate it. This is a very tricky, tricky thing to pull off, because you have to do it in such a way that doesn't prompt an attack or a retaliation on South Korea. And I don't mean even a big retaliation, just some retaliation, which of course does enormous harm to our alliance with South Korea. Doesn't alarm the Chinese, doesn't cause something even bigger to spread and escalate. And if I thought you had the A team in running this operation, right, if you told me that, Colin Powell, Brent Scowcroft, the elder President Bush were in charge, they were going to try and put something like this together, I'd still think it was a bad idea, but I think they might have a chance of pulling this one off. I do not have the confidence that this White House could pull anything as subtle or sophisticated as that off without messing it up. Or just having it leak a week beforehand and cause a giant diplomatic kerfluffle as well. So,
we have a question from a remote location. How do you feel about Obama's foreign policy? Was it unique in any way?
I don't think it was unique. I think he was, in a sense, I had great admiration for President Obama, but he disappointed me repeatedly. I think his instincts on many foreign policy issues were actually pretty good, but he was, in fact, just one person and a prisoner of this establishment about which I've now written a book about. So Barack Obama, very smart, intelligent, sensible Nobel Peace Prize winner, escalated the war in Afghanistan, even though he knew it wasn't going to actually fix anything. Right? It wasn't going to put us in a better position in Afghanistan at the end of his term, and it didn't. Barack Obama, I think, had the right idea that we needed a peace deal in the Middle East, that that would be good for us, good for Israel, good for the Palestinians, good for the Arab world. He was never actually willing to put any genuine pressure on both sides, et cetera. I think in any number of other ways, he had, you know, excellent instincts on a lot of things, but wasn't able to change American policy very much. So at the end of the day, oh, I left out Libya, right? I mean, he said later that that was his greatest regret, right, was that he had gotten persuaded to try something in Libya, even though we'd seen that movie before in other places. And we should have by then learned that the only thing worse than a really awful government, which of course is what the Gaddafi regime was, the only worse than a really awful government is no government at all, about which Thomas Hobbes wrote his book Leviathan, about the state of nature, and that's what we ended up with in places like that. So Barack Obama, I think, was a very good man and a very disappointing president.
Balcony question over here.
My name is Norman Keeling from University of Maine Belfast Hutchinson Center. My concern is the question, who is advising Trump? Who are the true advisors, and how do we identify them and hold them accountable?
Well, I don't know what I don't know, so I don't know if he has a set of advisors that have whose identities have remained secret, but I'll say a couple things. I mean, first of all, accountability is kind of a concept that has disappeared before Trump. It disappeared long before that. Ask yourself how many people who've held high positions in the U.S. government in the foreign policy realm have ever done anything that would disqualify them from serving again. Nobody's ever held accountable. We recycle the same officials in and out, regardless of how badly they performed the last time around. So there's not a whole lot of accountability. The people who thought up, again, the invasion of Iraq, as near as I can tell, none of them paid any sort of personal price for doing so as well. So accountability is kind of out of this thing long before Trump showed up. Second point is, you know, who does he rely on? He'll rely upon H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor. I think he does listen to Secretary of Defense Mattis as well. Takes some advice from his inner circle, just like his predecessors do. Or did, rather. Barack Obama had an inner circle of people that he trusted on foreign policy. He didn't listen to Hillary Clinton when she was, I mean, he listened, but she did not run foreign policy when she was Secretary of State, and I don't think John Kerry ran it. He was given certain assignments that he pursued very energetically, and in some cases, I think, successfully, mostly not successfully. And the reason why all these presidents have this inner circle is, of course, the importance of loyalty, which is also something that is increasingly missing. So get back to Barack Obama. He keeps on Robert Gates as Secretary of Defense, holdover from the Bush administration. Gates serves a couple of years, leaves, writes a memoir, sticks the knife right in Barack Obama's back. And then Leon Panetta, who Barack Obama first appointed to head the CIA and then moves over to defense, does the same thing. Leaves, writes a memoir while Obama is still in office. Well, if you're living in an environment like that, of course you want to have your inner circle. If you're Barack Obama, you want Bed Rhodes, you want Valerie Jarrett, you want people who you know will not betray you. If you're Donald Trump, you want Jared Kushner, you want Ivanka. You want some people, regardless of their qualifications or lack of same, who you know are tied to you completely and therefore are not going to go spill something outside in a way that might embarrass you as well. And I think this is actually a serious problem in just in terms of public service, that increasingly leaders do not have enough people around them or people they can appoint whom they can trust.
Question down here.
Charlotte Singleton from Mount Desert Island. This is a broad question, but I'm curious. The demographic
demographics of the United States are changing, and changing rapidly. What do you think, or will this affect foreign policy in the future? That is in terms of relationships, but also in terms of the formulation of foreign policy.
Well, one of the things that I think has happened, and I see it teaching at the Kennedy School, and you see it when you go to Washington and you go through different agencies, of course, is it is not the sort of white Anglo-Saxon Protestant elite that you might have envisioned from a bygone generation running foreign policy. It looks like America, which I think is a wonderful thing. And my students reflect that too. That's going to change things, I think, a little bit, because you are going to get some broader perspectives. I don't have anything profound to say about this, except to say that I think this will, over time, further erode the sort of reflexive sense we have that Europe is our point of origin and that the transatlantic community is this deep, integral, organic thing, because the United States was, you know, founded primarily by people who fled Europe and came here, and that many Americans could trace their ancestry pretty closely back there. Well, as we have more people coming from Latin America and more people coming from Asia and other parts of the world to the United States, that sense of a sort of organic tie to Europe that people have because, you know, their grandfather came from Denmark, true in my case, their father, you know, fled Hungary or whatever, I think that's going to erode. It won't disappear. It won't be completely gone. And the history, the historical and institutional and cultural links will still be there. But in a sense, we are going to be a more cosmopolitan country, and that is going to encourage a more cosmopolitan outlook on the rest of the world, I hope.
We've just heard some excerpts from a question and answer session at the 2018 Camden Conference with our featured speaker on today's program, Dr. Stephen Walt. The session was moderated by Gordon Adams. This program and all of the programs produced by WERU for the 2018 Camden Conference are available for listening on demand on the web at weru.org. For more information about the Camden Conference, please go to camdenconference.org. Thanks for listening to this WERU presentation from the 2018 Camden Conference.